welcome to edition 348 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound.
On today's show, we'll be talking branding and how to go about it with a touch of wit with ad man Greg Quinton. He's the co-author of a new book profiling some of the best ad campaigns in the last 25 years, A Smile in the Mind.
And we'll also be meeting the mind behind a pop culture classic post-punk band, Public Image Limited's iconic metal box album. Photographer and artist Dennis Morris designed it, and he'll be telling us more about his time spent with the band, the Sex Pistols, Bob Marley, and even more.
And we'll be undertaking some space travel from the comfort of Studio One. Composer Arthur Jeffs from the Penguin Cafe Ensemble will be telling us why he's now making tunes out of gravitational waves. Sounds heavy.
That's all to come, plus Monocle's Daniel Giacopelli will be making a long overdue return to the news look ahead hot seat, and we'll play some tunes too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
There we have it, Andrew. It says this is edition 348 of the Monocle Weekly. The way it's going today, it feels like it's 3,400,800.
Well, we shouldn't normally reveal this bit, but we read the menu, and if anything goes wrong, we read the menu again. And when you've got post-punk band Public, is one of those.
Yeah.
It's a very complicated thing to say.
It's a wonder you haven't picked up a number of penguins already, yes. Isn't it, Andrew, really?
Especially if you're an idiot like me. But anyway, I got through it somehow, and here we are on the other side.
We've struggled through. It's okay. How's your week been? Has it been a nice one? It's felt relaxing in the office. A little bit dull.
A little bit. Well, we had a huge mega buster of an issue kind of kicked out the door last Saturday.
You've got the postnatal depression of the magazine.
Yeah, so you come back in and you feel a bit kind of like smacked in the mouth.
You do feel run over by
the editorial process.
Run over by the April issue.
So with a slightly fat lip, I got through kind of like the beginning of the week.
And that's why we're finding it so difficult to get our words out, I think.
Because I've got a big smack in the lip.
Yeah, exactly. We're both kind of fumbling through broken teeth. Shall we wheel out our news look ahead aficionado? He's back.
Let's wheel him out.
Danny, there's no other but Danny. There's a lover, my Danny, and I love him more each day.
That's my sentiment too.
My harem returns.
Where have you been?
Tom Edwards takes precedence over me these days, so he... But he's looking after his child, I think, today.
Oh, is he? Yeah.
He's gone. He's left the building.
Okay.
So I'm the B.
And I didn't know that's how he referred to Steve, but there you go. That's one of those things. where do you want to start?
All right.
What a funny looking baby you've got.
So next week, South by Southwest.
I know that direction.
Does that mean anything to anybody?
Yes. Films.
Yep. Austin film. Well, films, tech, music, it's everything. Digital advertising. Rob, have you been?
I haven't been.
You haven't been? Okay. No.
I think it's one of those things you kind of need to really know what you're doing, or you can't see the wood for the trees.
Mm,
I've kind of thought, oh God, I don't know. Let's get someone in. Let's get an expert in and have them tell us how to get around it.
Yeah, so it's 139 films.
Yeah.
14 North American premieres, 89 world premieres. So it's quite a large, and of course all the music too.
Yeah, it was originally a music festival. Wasn't
Indeed,
it? It was a kind of music festival, and then a music conference, and then everything kind of else got sort of tacked onto the side of it. With the death of the music industry, then came the technology stuff, and then the films came along with it. It's a bit of a behemoth.
I wouldn't call it the death of the music industry, but it's...
Oh, here's a man who just made a couple of shows about the music industry.
Yeah, I mean, it's going through some issues, but...
It's going through some issues. Yeah.
Also, we should be calling it South By, because that's what the cool cats say.
Oh, is that what they call it, South By?
Yeah.
So what do we call it, South By Southwest?
I said South By Southwest, but that's like saying, you know...
I like to give it
the Facebook or something like that.
Like I call it, the Radioheads.
The Google. All right, let's move on. This week, next week, is 3 years since the Pope became the Pope. 3 year anniversary of Cardinal Jorge Mario Bergoglio, now known as Pope Francis.
What happens on the Pope's investiture to the papacy? What do you think? The Vatican, lots of cake?
Throw him a party.
Yeah.
He lives a very frugal lifestyle, though.
Yeah. Carrot cake.
Yeah, carrot cake, okay. Dunkin' Donuts coffee, maybe.
Dunkin' Donuts.
And I presume they were cheering for the Oscars when Spotlight won Best Film.
Oh, jeez.
No, I think actually the Vatican put out...
Do you think so?
No, the Vatican put out a message saying it shone a light on important issues.
It certainly did.
But it's interesting. I think, you know, yes, he's had an interesting 3 years, and he's done lots of reformist things. But when you see these cases rattling on about kind of like, you know, abuse of children in Australia and et cetera, you kind of realise it as an institution, for him, even if he wants to change it and make it feel a bit more responsive and a bit more kind of credible, it's a tough beast to turn around.
Yeah, I mean, it is indeed. That's all. I'm going to leave it there. let's move on, actually, to something quite fun. It's the Ice Run motorbike race across Siberia. So this sees teams traveling 2,500 kilometers across Siberia in old-school motorbikes with sidecars, and it sees the teams enduring temperatures as low as minus 52 degrees, at which point the metal snaps and the oil solidifies, I've been told.
I think you might end up looking like that gentleman on the Philippines boat. They discovered him after 20 years floating around in the sea.
Yeah, what a photo that was.
That was great,
wasn't
it?
I can't believe they ran that photo on the front cover of all the papers. The mummified corpse of a sailor. It's kind of shocking.
Well, I think it's because he looked just a bit dusty.
He looked like he was just gone to sleep.
Okay.
He looked like a man that just...
And I think that's what you might look like in the sidecar when they kind of prized it open after 2,500 kilometers.
Yeah.
This week, it is the Romantic Novelists Association Romantic Novel of the Year Awards.
That's good.
Basically,
where does that take place, Danny?
It takes place in London.
Right.
And the winner wins £5,000. and they win a special glass trophy, which is then passed on to the next year's recipient. So you don't even get to keep it. It's kind of like...
Is it a test tube?
It's kind of like the America's Cup, I think, in sailing, where you just kind of you have it for a year and then...
Well, like many trophies, you get a replica of it, don't you? You don't get the actual one.
Is that
Yeah, you know, you don't get to keep the Wimbledon trophy. You give it to the next man, don't you?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah. This next one's great, though, guys.
Never won a trophy there, Danny Jacopola. Never won a prize.
I've won all kinds of prizes, Rob.
Yes, of course he'd say
look
that.
Look what I'm giving you right now.
What are you giving me?
It's the World Clown Association's annual conference in Orlando, Florida this
God,
week.
God, that's terrifying. Look at the man who's advertising it.
I just handed you the advertisement, the flyer, really.
Yeah, yeah.
It looks as you would expect. Lots of Comic Sans, lots of clowns.
Yeah.
It's in Orlando, which I just find hilarious because, of course, it's in Florida. And we should actually send someone. We should send Ed Stocker down there.
Yeah, not me. I don't like clowns. I never liked them as a kid. They petrified me.
They terrified me as a child. Looking at these, it's...
Do you not like clowns either?
Well, no. It's really strange.
I don't mind
clowns.
I don't find them funny. I'm sorry. But also, isn't it strange that this famous clown is called Iman Lizarazu, and it says, the Iman will show you to do workshops at the convention. It's a bit confusing.
Why is that?
Well, because he sounds like an imam.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
As in, like, he's a holy
religious
man
person.
From a
religious
maybe he is.
Yeah.
Finally, the world's largest arts and antiques fair in the Netherlands this week, which actually sounds quite interesting, the European Fine Art Fair. 200 dealers go there from 14 countries, everything you can imagine. We should be checking that out. Finally, this is a public service announcement for everybody. It's daylight savings on the 13th in the US, which is quite important. Big campaign to abolish it, actually.
Yeah.
Because it screws up business, it screws up people's... livelihoods in some cases.
And also, we have to change all the clocks here at Midori House.
Indeed.
And also all the time checks. You have to be careful what time it is in the world.
Yes, it does affect international radio stations as well.
Give Tom Edwards a ring at home and tell him to put Steve down and change the clocks.
Danny, can I just flag up the pen that you're using so you make notes on your papers for this news look ahead? I didn't think they still made those. That's a Beryl... One of those Beryl colouring in pens.
I got this from the office.
Since, like, prep
this
school.
Is actually the best pen in the office. There's a lot of competing views on the best pen in the office. There's quite a lot around here, but this one that I'm holding right here.
That takes me back. I love that.
The best.
Nice. Well, sponsored by the Beryl Colorama, whatever they're called. Danny Jacopelli, thank you very much for next week's news. Around 20 years ago, the book A Smile in the Mind caused a pleasant ripple in the branding world by collecting some of the best examples of wit, playfulness and humour created by quick-minded creatives over the past couple of decades. It was compiled by co-founder of The Partners, David Stewart, and design writer Beryl McAlone.
Now the book has received a welcome update overseen by current partners, executive creative director Greg Quinton, along with original writers Stuart McElhone and fellow branding maestro Nick Asbury. Greg joins us now to tell us what's changed in the past two decades of design and branding and what remains that's still managing to raise a smile. Greg, let's dive in. First of all, the notion of wit and humour. When you go through the book, it's not all kind of belly laugh stuff. You realise there's a great deal of just kind of nice cleverness around many of these campaigns. When does a brand decide that that is the right kind of message rather than something that's just, you know, plain, straightforward brand explanation? Where does humour become a good selling tool?
Well, wit is an intelligent form of humour, so therefore it's subtler. And I guess brands want to communicate with an audience, and if they are an intelligent brand, if they're a sophisticated brand, then the humour should be at that level and talk to audiences in that level. When a brand is talking slapstick and humour, then belly laughs, that's great, but it only lasts for so long. Intelligent humour is humour where your brain, as the audience, is your brain is engaged and they have to add something to the process. So it's 1 + 1 = 3. And when that happens, then it stays in the memory for the audience as well. So they become part of it and they believe that the brand is connected with them in some way. In the same way as Innocent, for example, the little bottles of the instructions on the back became a way of communicating with the audience as though they felt as though it was a one-to-one relationship, and that's real bonding.
And we'll pick your brains about examples, but one of the things that strikes me is when you look back at this book, here are examples often from like 20, 30 odd years ago, and they really stand the test of time, that done well, wit has a timelessness where you would imagine that actually wit and humour were so kind of embedded in the moment that they would kind of fade and pass. But actually, they've got legs, haven't they?
Well, that's the great thing about wit, because it's not a style-based thing. It's an engagement. It's like telling a joke, and a joke lasts forever. The same jokes go round and round again, but it's a subtler form of that. So, I mean, there's an old quote from Victor Borges that laughter is the shortest distance between two people. And, you know, what's interesting is that if you can share a joke, it will last forever.
I wanted to ask you something, because it always fascinates me, the day and the manner in which these campaigns are arrived at, or the zinger, you know, the strap line on these things, whether they're online advertisements or whether they're billboards or whether they end up on the television. Because I guess you need, ad agencies like yours need clients that have a great confidence in them, so that there isn't too much committee, that single people are allowed to run with it and are allowed their head. Were you tempted sometimes to put in the manner in which these things were arrived at, rather than simply, you've got some very neat and witty captions?
Yes. There is some explanation in some of the copy, and particularly in the back, where we've got the interviews with designers who write about the experience of that process and how they came up with the idea. And a lot of that is getting it through the decision process. Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, you've got to look at brands like Apple and Steve Jobs being personally involved in the marketing. Yeah. The best communication, for sure, is one that is being decided by an individual rather than a committee. You know, we all know the jokes about what you get from a committee. Yeah. It's the same with
marketing. And no statues being erected in their honour.
Yeah, precisely.
I was going to ask you another thing, that advertising seems, as Andrew's saying, it's one of those things that sort of riffs off cliche, you know, it riffs off an assumed truth amongst the populace for whom it's meant. Do you find that populace is narrowing? Do you find that cliche, the idea of cliche, the idea of sort of a shared truth is kind of narrowing, as there are so many platforms that advertising have to sit on nowadays?
Absolutely. I think also the speed in which everything is shared means that it can just be in one platform. I mean, Dumb Ways to Die, brilliant campaign about rail safety and prevention of mucking around on tracks in Australia. That campaign is so charming, so witty, and it's been shared on YouTube 122 million times, and that's effectively an advertising campaign for a railway safety in Australia.
Do you think there's a separation now between, you know, in this office, it even happens occasionally, someone sends you a GIF or a meme or something, potentially of a dog even. And you know, there is that kind of like the instant world of the digital, that, you know, when you look at many of the best pieces of work in here, they were done in print, they were slow burns, they were subtle, whether, you know, they were for media companies or for advertising, they were out there and they built up over a long, long time. Mm. Is there, do you think, a temptation for some brands now to think, okay, we'll do something a bit kind of mainstream classic in print and maybe for TV, and we'll save our wit and humour for the digital sphere? Because it's interesting that often big brands, they do the kind of straightforward kind of marketing to the masses, and then they seem to save some of their humour for a more kind of like guerrilla campaign, as it were.
Mm. It's interesting with Google, for example, that's the odd thing with Google is we live with the humour day in, day out with the Google doodles, because that level of engagement on a daily basis means that we bond with them as a brand. They don't really use a lot of wit elsewhere. Now, I don't think they use print at all.
So, but it's interesting with the Google thing, because I guess, you know, that you, there's the confidence of a brand that knows it can play around with its typography and its image on a daily basis. And that's what the wit kind of strikes you as. When you've gone through the book, are there some examples that jump out as you as kind of your favourite examples of how wit has worked?
Yes. I mean, I think Google is actually up there with that, because I think without that levelling of the humour with every day with Google, I think we would view Google as a completely different brand. And the importance of wit for big organisations like that, I think Coke, with a lot of the applications of recent years, the cans, the posters, there are lovely subtle things that go on there. You've mentioned the banana already. I mean, the banana packaging, I just love the idea of that you can walk into a supermarket and you've got a choice. Here's a banana juice in a conventional bit of packaging with type everywhere and probably a picture of a banana. That says banana juice. Great. And then next to it, this pack that just looks like a banana. It replicates banana in every single way. All the information is contained on that sticker. That is just stripped down to its simplest form, and I love the contrast between those two. The HEMA website, which is HEMA, the Dutch store, they're Dutch, so they're a little bit mad. No, I probably shouldn't say that, should I?
No, it's fine. You can say
they've got a great history of quite wacky advertising, haven't they?
They have indeed. The thing about this website, you get to this...
We'll put an asterisk on that and say, in a good way.
In a good way, absolutely, absolutely. So you get to the website, and it looks like a conventional shopping site, and you're looking at it, and you can't actually move your mouse on it, but suddenly one thing moves, and it knocks something else knocks something else, and the whole website just kind of cascades into this big crashing party, and the toasters are going off, and it hits the champagne bottle. It's just crazy, and it's just it playing with the product. It makes you really bond with the product. Well, you don't really bond with the product, but you love this company because of this.
It sounds like a sort of Heath Robinson
it's
party.
It's just like Heath Robinson. It really is. Yeah. It's just wonderful. I have a particular fondness for a very, very subtle poster series that NASA did for the planet they discovered, Kepler-186f. And what they did was they replicated the traditional travel posters of bygone era, beautiful graphic posters with looks like a normal scene. And then you look at it and you think, well, hang on, what's going on here? Because then you realise that the trees are bright red, and actually the people in the distance, they're actually astronauts. And it just says, where the grass is always redder on the other side. So it's just taking the convention of a travel poster and just switching it into being this new, imagining this new planet.
You have a beautiful stamp in there as well, I think a British stamp, which is for Passchendaele, and you realise it's a poppy, and when you see in the redness, you see the silhouettes of the soldiers as the seed heads as well.
Mm. And I think all of Noma Bahl's work, we're very, very familiar with it, with the IBM work, but that game of looking into it and then spot, you think it's one thing and then you see another thing. So, you know, there's an illustration of what looks like a house, and then you realise that actually it's also a man with a walking stick, or vice versa, depending on what you see first. And, you know, it's just kind of that lovely kind of wit of just you spot one thing and then you see another. Even the FedEx logo, where you finally spot the arrow inside it, and then, you know, you tell that to somebody else passes on to somebody else. I bet that has been more powerful for them as a device than any advertising, just because it makes people bond with the brand. Have you seen the arrow in the FedEx
logo?
People
love to find stuff like that.
They do.
Like making John McEnroe out with a £5 note.
Indeed.
people are going to write in about this, and that's a good thing. Maybe we'll have to put up a video on the monocle.com to show how you achieved that.
Go on then.
But I think it's probably, I don't know whether it's treason or sacrilege. It's one of the two.
I like what else did I got. The ideas you've chosen is there is a kind of internationalism. You can imagine them working almost every place. I guess the thing you also realize about a good piece of wit, it's so stripped back. It's so kind of trimmed and pruned and polished. And I think when many people look at these things, they say, oh, that would be simple. Mm. But even like the campaign for one of our kind of rivals, as it were, The Economist, all of the work that they did with text, you realise that there was a huge amount of thinking behind those. They weren't that simple to do.
It's the hardest thing is to do the simple. Yeah. It really is. And I think that's probably why this is graphic wit, because it's about being stripped back. It is about being simple. There are similar ideas out there that do the same game, but they're not stripped back to the same level. They're not simple enough. They're not graphic enough. And that the graphic design element of this has now, in a way, moved on to being more about graphic. So simple wit. So, you know, the giant rubber ducks, for example, that's not a graphic design piece. That's an art piece. It went around the world and it engaged everybody. Huge audiences turned up to see an inflatable rubber duck, big inflatable rubber duck. But, you know, hundreds of thousands of people went to see that thing.
And is that the secret, the international reach of these things? That I suppose this is, when there's visual wit involved, most of those cliches, as we call them, most of that sort of shared knowledge is kind of an international thing. Is it the problem when you get kind of copy-heavy advertising that simply can't cross boundaries? We've had in this studio before, Andrew, the people behind the Volkswagen ads in the 60s and the 70s. And David Abbott wrote that beautiful copy for those ads. And the pictures were fantastic. And either could almost exist without the other. But I guess you see less of that because ads have to stretch around the world, whereas before they were just very territorial.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah. I mean, but arguably the tortoise ad would have worked in any country, because there's no words, I don't think. I think words can be wonderful forms of wit, and there's a lot of examples in here where it's all about the wit of the word. But I think also it's true that the non-verbal wit is very, very powerful, because everybody can understand it.
And just tell me finally, your guardianship of this book. This is a book that existed some years ago. It became a classic. And then somebody obviously tapped you on the shoulder. So I think it's your job to update this and give it a bit more kind of contemporary integrity. Yes. Has it been a kind of a scary thing to do, to meddle with something that was a classic?
Yes. In a word. It has become a book that, certainly in the design industry, has become a little bit of, you know, almost Bible-esque. And therefore, we were terrified about touching it. I think also, to be honest, I think it probably went out of fashion for a little while. Technology came along and it was, you know, far more interesting things to play with. And I think that's come full circle. I think the cyclical nature of design and wit has come around. And I think now people are interested in deeper relationships. Yes, it was terrifying, because it was very difficult to start mucking around with something that's held in reverence. I mean, I was interviewed in the original book. I've got lots of work in the original book. So I feel like it's part of my life. It's absolutely David and Beryl's piece, and they created this wonderful thing in the beginning. All Nick and I really have done is just built on it and added to the content so that it is up to date.
And actually, there's plenty to read in there, but there's not too many words, because any good joke doesn't need explaining. Right?
Absolutely.
Greg Quinton, the man behind A Smile in the Mind, does exactly what it says on its beautiful, bold cover. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
We're going to spin a tune now, if that's the right terminology these days. In a moment, we'll be speaking to Dennis Morris, designer of the band Public Image Limited's Metal Box album cover. So let's enjoy a classic from that band. This is Public Image Limited with Rise.
Could be wrong. I could be wrong.
That was Public Image with Rise. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
The roadhouses along the Great Northern Highway in Western Australia are vital, serviceable sanctuaries for the truck drivers who frequent them. Monocle correspondent Liam Aldous and photographer Graham Miller hit the road to meet the colourful characters who rely on these outback pit stops.
In the town of Kew, we saw firsthand how the historical peaks and troughs of Western Australia's mining boom have shaped the man-made landscape. It was here we met the self-designated Queen of the Murchison, Carla Nilsson. She shared plenty of terrific and maybe tall tales involving modern-day helicopter-riding prospectors, film crews, and even a delegation from the Perth Paranormal Society who had dropped by to inspect the allegedly haunted old Freemasons Lodge around the corner.
Stop and Start, a photographic essay now playing in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Dennis Morris has a unique story in British photography and design, having started using cameras from the age of 8 around his home of Hackney in London. By age 11, his photos had appeared on the cover of the UK paper, The Daily Mirror. More on that later.
By the age of 17, Dennis was shooting London's vibrant music scene, touring with the likes of Bob Marley and befriending Sex Pistol John Lydon. Dennis later became art director for Island Records, but his vision went beyond photography, helping define the image of Lydon's later post-punk band Public Image Limited, also known as Pill. Their famed album cover for the record Metal Box, a metallic circular case never seen before as a vinyl record, was Dennis's design. Now his work with the band is on show in a new exhibit at London's ICA, Dennis Morris, Pill, first issue to Metal Box, and he joins us now to talk us through it. Dennis, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you, Will.
And congratulations on that amazing career of work. I don't know where to start. I do know where to start. let's start with Metal Box, with that thing. Public Image were keen to promote just that thing. John Lydon had certainly a very different image to his stuff with the Sex Pistols. What was that like, banging around ideas for with John Lydon for this very personal project, it seems like, for both of you?
Yeah, well, that kind of came about really from an adventure that we had, which is basically Virgin had decided they wanted to get involved with reggae music, and they set up the Frontline label. So I had a call from Richard Branson and said he wanted me to go to Jamaica with him, to the idea being that he'd sign the bands and then I would do the shots for the album cover and press purposes and promotion, etc. So I turned to him and said, why don't we take John, because John's such a big reggae fan. And he said, yeah, great idea. So a couple of weeks later, we jumped on a plane and arrived in Kingston. We stepped out and out of the airport, and there was a group of Rastas, and they saw John and said, Johnny Rotten, man, God save the Queen, man. From that moment on, we knew we were cool. For over a few weeks, we had this adventure where we were going around, like from studio to studio, with from Big U's studio to Lee Perry's studio. And that's where the idea for Pill was really formulated, was in Jamaica. So by the time John came back, you know, he had this idea together, you know, in his mind, and he put the band together. And eventually when he came to Metal Box, he said, I want to call this album Metal Box. And I said, oh, you know what? Every morning I'd pass this factory on my way to secondary school called the Metal Box Factory. And I said, I must go and check them out. So I went down and saw them, you know. And it turned out they made film canisters, which was exactly the same size as vinyl. So I just said to him, how much would it cost to buy like a job lot, a couple of thousand? They gave me a price, and I asked them how much it would be to emboss the Pill logo, and they gave me a price. I went to see Virgin, told them, and they said, well, you know, it'd be too expensive. I said, no, you know, this is the price. And they said, okay, it's reasonable. So we did a couple of thousand, I think, a limited edition, and that's how it was born.
Tell us how you got to know John Lydon, and you know, you were meeting him at a period, you know, I presume after the, you know, the crash and burn of the Sex Pistols in many ways, and here he is trying to get another career going, and he produces an album that many look back on and think of it as being an absolute classic of its time, a piece of gritty hard work in many ways. What was the reality that we were seeing, you know, in our newspapers and the world of John Lydon, and then working with him as a musician and working on branding and working on all these other elements too?
Well, everything, you know, with John and around the whole punk period, it was very, very, it was total chaos. It was absolutely chaotic. And then after the Pistols, like as you say, crashing and burning, you know, with the pill scenario, again, it was really quite chaotic. I mean, we were all very young. I kind of remember the, you know, when John got the first advance for the album, he had his flat in Gunter Grove. And so every member of the band sort of had their own sort of things they're into. Like, for instance, Keith Levine, guitarist, he was into ready control things. So we'd be sitting in this enormous lounge and there'd be all these things whizzing around your head. John was really into Guinness, so he had these huge kegs of Guinness, you know, and we'd just get up and sort of things on tap. I mean, it was crazy, but it was very innovative in terms of ideas just flying around, you know, and things. It was a very creative time.
I mean, just tell me the alliance between the world of reggae and the world of punk. They weren't always seen as, you know, natural bedfellows, as it were.
Yeah.
Did that come about partly through yourself?
Kind of, but at the same time, what it was through punk, you know, was totally against the sort of established rock music at the time. And the only music that was rebellious or saying anything was reggae music. So therefore, any time you went to any kind of punk club, that's what you'd hear was reggae music. Because the truth of it is, there was very, very few punk records that was actually playable in that sense. So, you know, yeah, there was a lot of reggae music being played. So that created that fusion, that sort of interest in reggae. And basically as well, punk also launched the career in a sense of Bob Marley. It really helped put Marley on another level. You know, it was a beautiful moment, beautiful time.
And you're obviously right in the thick of it. We mentioned working with Bob Marley in our introduction there, Dennis. Tell us about that. How did you get into that world?
I was this young kid who was in love with photography, searching, you know, trying to find a way in. And I was in my last year at school and I'd read he was coming over to Bob Marley to do his first tour of England. And so I really wanted to take some pictures of him. So he was playing a club called the Speakeasy Club in the West End. So I bunked off school, went down to the club and waited and waited. And eventually Ian the Wailers turned up. And I walked up to him and said, could I take a picture? He said, yeah, man, come in. So I went in and they were doing their sound check. I was taking pictures of them. And then during breaks, he'd ask me what it was like to be a young black kid in England. I was asking him what Jamaica was like.
Yeah.
And he told me about the tour and then said to me if I'd like to come along. So I said, yeah. So next morning, I packed my bags as if I was going to sports and went to the hotel. And in those days, I didn't have a tour bus, it was a transit van, and jumped in the transit van. There's a very famous picture of him looking back and he was looking at me saying, you ready, Dennis?
Yeah.
Yeah. And he started from there. And what happened, though, it was funny because...
What was in the back of the transit, quickly?
Just equipment.
Just no seats or nothing?
Just seats and stuff, but yeah. You
okay,
know, but,
good answer.
A lot of that was there as well. but I'll get to that. But actually, what happened was, it was winter, and it was a really bitter winter. And one morning, I think like the fourth day in a tour, they decided that they wanted to play football. So I opened the window, the curtains, and they looked out. And they're like, oh, what up? So I said, snow, Bob. So what do you mean snow? I said, you know, snow. So, like, so Peter Tosh and Bunny Whaler was convinced it was a sign of Jah that they should leave Babylon. And they had this massive argument amongst themselves. And they wouldn't go and continue the tour. So the tour collapsed. and then they went back to Jamaica. But there's this very famous shot of mine of him smoking this spliff, and he was there, he said to him, let me show you how to smoke a spliff, Dennis. And there was three frames, fourth frame I was gone.
Right, yeah.
It was a crazy time, really was. But Bob was something, that man was really super special. He really was.
And was he, I mean, we're talking about two very different people, but, you know, as you were telling us, maybe less separate in the popular imagination than you're painting, Bob Marley and John Lydon. Did Bob Marley have a very, you know, you're laying down images which define people, all these photographs, you mentioned two of your famous ones of Bob Marley there. Did he have a similar knowledge that this was defining him, that he wanted to have a record and these would become icons?
Yeah, Bob really, what was unique about him was he actually knew that he had a mission, and he also knew the power of images as well. So when he saw those images of mine, he knew that I understood what he was aiming for, what he wanted to portray in that sense. So he was very, very unique in that, he really was. But what I learned and what I got from, say, you know, working with the Sex Pistols and with Bob Marley, see, what I got from Bob Marley, I got a sense of spirituality, of a self-being, of, you know, an inner self. And then with the Sex Pistols, I learned how to kick the door down. So, you know, so so once I kicked the door down, I knew how to keep myself together.
You could be both artist and manager in one.
And tell me, you know, the camera in your hand, I guess when we're, you know, when you see amazing music photography, the best music photography, it's, of course, you know, it's a depiction of a time and a moment. But as you say, that it touches on these deeper things that the person is thinking or feeling, and often has a kind of, you know, a hint at what may be about to come. You often read into these pictures extraordinary things. Why do you think your photos have had this kind of amazing longevity and an ability to kind of capture people at the time? Is it because you had this kind of friendship with people, because they were relaxed in your company? What gave you that deeper access with your pictures?
Well, the truth of it is, I never really set out to be a rock photographer. That was never my ambition. I wanted to be a war photographer. So my influence was reportage. And reportage is, as a medium, as a technique, is the study of the human psyche, you know, from when you look at images of Cartier-Bresson, whatever. So it's really about studying someone, learning about somebody, getting close to somebody, and then leading up to that moment and then capturing that defining moment as such. So none of the images of Bob or the Sex Pistols were taken in a photo studio. They're all sort of like with Bob and I just sitting, talking, and the same with the Sex Pistols, you know. So it was being able to read a situation, getting to know your subject, know what your subject is about, and then ultimately then to take away that mask to then for them to reveal the inner self. And once you get that, when the viewer looks at the picture, the viewer then feels that they are part of that image, that they were there in the room or in that situation. That's what the beauty of that technique.
And tell us about that picture, that fabled picture then that you got on the front cover of the Daily Mirror when you were 11 years old. Hook and by crook, there it appears.
Yeah. Well, there was a man who basically I owe a lot to. His name is Donald Patterson, who's not with us anymore. And he was, I was in a choir in St. Mark's in Dawson. And the vicar of that church had this bizarre concept of having the choir boys wearing Eton suits. So, the congregation was predominantly black, and the choir boys were all black.
Yeah.
So you can imagine like, all of us, there's like the height of 80 black kids in these Eton suits, you know, like with the big white collars and dinner jackets. And he couldn't afford it, so he put an ad in the Times looking for a benefactor, and a man called Donald Patterson, who was an inventor and manufacturer of photographic equipment, had made a fortune and wanted to put something back. And he saw the ad, got involved with the church, and one of the things he did was create a photographic club. So when I was like 8, I went into the darkroom, I saw this older boy take this piece of paper, put it on this thing, which I didn't know at the time was called an enlarger, switched on the light, image came onto the paper, a few seconds, took the paper, put it into this dish and rocked it. And this image appeared, and I just thought, wow, magic. Yeah. And I was smitten, that was it. For me, I just knew that was my luck, going to be my life. And Mr. Patterson saw my enthusiasm and took me under his wing, and literally, he taught me everything. But one of the things I used to do, straight after church, I used to take off my Eton suit and go down to Hyde Park. Every Sunday I would do that because, you know, speakers' corners, that's where every amateur goes. And then one particular Sunday, there was this huge demonstration, and I had a few rolls of films, you know, and it just got bigger and bigger and it got more violent. And Mr. Patterson always used to say to me, if you think you've got something, take it to the papers. And one of the things he always used to do was show me where Fleet Street was, blah, 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 take me to galleries, museums. So I thought, you know, I'd go down to Fleet Street. And I just walked into this agency, I think it was called UPI. Yeah, it was UPI. And I said I was there. And they were sending their photographer there because, you know, they knew it kicked off. And they developed the film. And unknown to me, I had a shot of one of the PLO leaders. And they paid me £16. And I thought, 16
yes,
quid
sir.
For a photo. Wow, man, you know, you've got to take this seriously.
Yeah.
And then that just really encouraged me, you know. And I never looked back.
Well, best of luck with the show. I can't wait to come and see it.
Thank you. It's going to be a great show, yeah.
Yeah, and Dennis Morris, thank you very much for your
time. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brûlé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
Composer and musician Arthur Jeffs is leader of the Penguin Cafe Ensemble, the collective who perform unconventional yet beautifully melodic pieces. But Arthur's been looking to the heavens recently, space in fact, because his latest compositions, part of a forthcoming project called Gravitational Waves and Exoplanets, are created with some help from space itself.
Arthur's been using data supplied by astrophysicist Samaya Nisanke, part of the LIGO-Virgo scientific collaboration team that have just announced the detection of gravitational waves, a landmark that recently proved Albert Einstein's theory of relativity. Along with Creative Studio, I almost said MILF, MLF, and Professor Jean-Michel Désert, Arthur has been transforming gravitational waveforms recorded from the furthest reaches of space into tunes. Before we speak with Arthur and get the lowdown on this, let's hear one. This is Killanova. Transporting stuff. Arthur Jeffs, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thanks for supplying that very kind of, a transporting piece of music as well. And this is obviously going to need some explaining. I mean, aside from the fact that music sounds melodic and beautiful, where on earth is it coming from?
That particular piece, everything that's going on there except for the strings, is derived from, in some way, from data coming from the LIGO Virgo project. The centerpiece of the whole thing is these chirps, which is, in effect, it's the sound of a black hole being born.
Wow.
Or, of two black holes colliding and creating a bigger, supermassive black hole.
And when that happens, it just goes, chirp.
Well, it's... the idea behind it is, it's sort of surprisingly simple. It's the idea that up to now we've been looking into the universe and into the deep universe using electromagnetic spectrum, things like light and radio waves, microwaves. And this gives us a really great, it's like looking into a room.
Right.
But there are some things in the universe which light can't escape, like black holes. At that point, you're looking at literally a black hole. But the rather beautiful thing that Einstein predicted was that space-time curvature behaves in such a way that when something really big happens, ripples spread out from that event.
Yeah.
So like if someone turns off a light in a room and someone makes a noise, you can hear it, but you can't see it. And so this is an entirely new sort of sense to be using. It's like listening instead of seeing. The medium that this comes through on is this thing, gravitational waves. They're very, very small. So small as to need very large events to create something which we can detect. I mean, that you're talking sort of 10,000th of the width of like a proton, very small.
This is amazing. So I love this.
And tell me how this. How does a process like you making this music begin? Was it you who phoned the astrophysicist and said, "Oh, hello, I see what you're up to. I'd like to have your data, please. I think it might make a nice tune." Or did they give you a call?
Well, oddly, it was because I did a project in 2012 working with NASA in San Francisco at the Ames base, working with an artist called Nelly Ben-Hayun.
Oh, yeah.
Where we created sort of various pieces of music, which then got beamed into space as part of the Kepler project. There is already this kind of established space music idea sort of floating in the background. And I went to school with Samaya, and I've always been incredibly sort of jealous of anyone who works in that field, because it's, you know, if I'd studied harder. But as it is, I do music. So we had this idea, general idea, that we've been speaking about for a couple of years, to work with her and her husband, Jean-Michel Désert, and he's an exoplanet hunter. And originally it was going to be just exoplanets, but then we realized that gravitational waves was an amazing candidate for this, because it's, you know, the raw evidence is sonic in the sense that it's a waveform.
So something that you're capturing and you're capturing and editing more than you are actually creating, in a sense here.
Yeah. So with the chirps that come through, it's basically the frequency over time goes up in an exponential rate as the orbiting bodies get closer and closer. They smash together. They create a black hole, and then light can't escape from the black hole. But the last bits of light that escape, they also create a waveform called the ring down. And these shapes can be used, well, I've used those to make sort of MIDI maps, which give you melodies and things to play on the piano. And
yeah, these are the kind of things. There's a metronomic sense to these things, right?
Well, there's sort of, on that one we just heard, there's sort of the gradual drop, like the just dropping melody. That comes from a light curve. But then the percussive sounds and the little scratchy noises, those come from actual models of chirps. And then those are the models that were used to test the actual raw data that came in and got announced, you know, 2.5 weeks ago.
Well, we've got a second excerpt here, which we should play. This is Black Hole 5.0.
Haunting bit of space melody called Black Hole 5.0. We're playing that because we have Arthur Jeffs in the studio talking us through this fantastic project. Man, you must have hated your bandmates in the Penguin Cafe to be working with sine waves. No, you're joking. So do you get the sense of space as this slightly blue thing, this slightly sad, big, huge thing? So, or do you get a sense that it is kind of a love story? Is it a...
Well, I think probably a little bit of both. If that makes sense. But this idea that there are dramatic events taking place in the sort of vastness of apparently empty space, I find is a sort of really beautiful, haunting idea. And then that particular piece, Black Hole, we're going to Prague to go and record all the strings done with a proper big Philharmonic orchestra. And I really like this idea of chopped up spacey noises with, you know, the most kind of humanistic idea of a, you know, big string section. And I think that kind of contrast, I think that'll be really good.
Yeah.
Well, nice. That one sounded like it could be a good club remix of that one as well, I think. I think you have a kind of rave version of that.
Falls to the floor, Andrew.
Yeah. Nice. Just tell me, for you, there's, you know, I understand there's a world of music and it's beautiful to produce. But on the other side of the equation, what do the astrophysicists hope to get out of this? Do they hope that you're humanizing their project in some way, that you're connecting? You know, there have been so many attempts to breach the science art divide for decades, for centuries. Is this another attempt at saying these two creative worlds, you know, they're not just divided by what happens to two people at school, but it goes on from there?
Yeah, well, I think the sense of wonder and just sort of joy that you get from talking to, you know, in this case, Sammy and Jean-Michel, I mean, they get so excited, and they're not in it for the dry sort of calculus stuff. They're in it for the, you know, these are the tools we use to get to grips with, you know, extraordinary frontiers of knowledge and really surprising results coming through. And, you know, they are, you know, it's exploring. And I think that's the side that's actually very easy to get across, and which music very much helps. Jean-Michel, when he describes this, you do just really start getting excited and feeling sort of quite childlike. But with Samaya talking about the black holes, you know, she sort of gets across this idea that neutron stars which I, before this project, had a vague idea what a neutron star was. I think, yeah, I knew it was maybe a collapsed other star, but beyond that, not much. Whereas now, to hear Sammy talk about it, it's like they're the unheralded workmen of the universe, and they go around doing all these amazing things, and they sort of start to take on personalities and these narratives of things generating and collapsing and regenerating. It's all very, very familiar. It's kind of, you know, stories of growth and change. And yeah, so it's not actually a big leap, I think, to put it to music.
I had a question, actually, for a composer that is obviously working with and obsessed by space at the moment. Mm. Is we always call on classical music, we always call on probably Holst, but Beethoven and all sorts of things. We think about the soundtracks to 2001, and we think about, you know, Gravity and movies like this. We always call on major chord classical music, and I wonder whether you wanted to maybe redress that balance and actually use the music of the universe, play it back to itself slightly.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think classical music is understandable first go-to.
And it's got grandeur to it.
It's got grandeur. It's that idea of, with all contemporary art, you know, the least you can say about it is it's created at the same time and in the same times that you as a sort of listener live in. And so there is a sort of immediacy to it. And so I think it's, I think it's probably quite a good addition to the conversation to actually do some new music.
Yeah.
And sort of make it a bit more up to date.
Don't doubt it now, you've started.
Nothing wrong with Strauss, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Arthur, thank you very much for your time on the Monocle Weekly. And Exoplanets is the thing to search for under your name with this, because it's kind of not quite finished, but that will get people in the right part of the internet.
Yeah, absolutely. Gravitational Waves and Exoplanets and Marshmallow Laser Feast. they're the visualization people. Those three elements are the ones.
Yeah. Beautiful stuff. Arthur, thank you very much.
Well, Rob, I feel my brain has been stretched.
I thought I had a brain, but actually it turned out it was a black hole 5.0.
I think you've been marshmallow laser beamed or something.
I really like that. I think that was quite a difficult thing to explain, Arthur's thing. But I really like the music, and the Penguin Cafe.
He's good.
And
yeah, the music are amazing. Oddly beautiful.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Did you know what a neutron star was? Did you? Everyone knows what a neutron star is.
I thought it was a type of sweet, but no, I didn't.
Dennis Morris, the man's a legend, and I like it when you get hoisted into the back of Bob Marley's tour bus, or Bob Marley's tour transit, the tender age of whatever he was, 15 or something.
And he wins the best outfit award as well.
Very good outfit, very good glasses.
Those glasses were like, they're good.
Yeah, really good. Would you go for a kind of bit of gold spangly joined up writing on the side of your specs?
Well, then he had a silver jacket as well. So the pairing of the metallic world was done with finesse. I liked
him. He was dressed as a metal box. And Greg Quinton, Smile in the Mind. It's become a bit of a design bible, that, hasn't it? A lot of acquisitive glances in our office when we brought that downstairs.
Yeah, it's published by Fiden, and so you can just go and look at their website if you want to buy a copy, or go to any good bookstore. But it really is a classic. You can't say enough about it, because there's just hundreds and hundreds of really, really, really interesting pictures and amazing kind of brand stories. And it's, yeah, I think I'm certainly taking my signed copy home.
Yeah, me too. Nice one. Let's thank our friends behind the glass. Today's show is produced by Tom Hall, researched by Yasmin Omar, and our studio manager wasn't Clara Barn, as it says on the script. It was Toby Hammond. The Monocle Weekly will be back again at the same time, same place next week. But for the time being, for me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.